Hi, welcome to the Health and Human Services Committee. We will be having some questions. If members could please sit down, if we could please get together, we will be beginning immediately. We do not yet have a quorum. However, we are going to go ahead and get going. If you could please hold your discussions, we're going to get started. We're going to have as member questions for the administration, and we are going to bring forward some commissioners from the agencies to answer questions that members have regarding the governor's budget and looking forward to the next 2 years. Could I please have Commissioner Berry come to the testifier table? Thank you for being available. And with that, we have quorum, and we will go ahead and call the meeting to order. Could I have a motion to approve the minutes from February 11, 2015?
So moved, Chairman.
Representative McDonald moves approval of the meeting. Any additions, subtractions, corrections to those? Seeing none, those minutes are approved. Members, if you would direct, we have the packets that are available for the budget, which you are available on the card if members want them. And we also do have representatives from the administration who've come forward for today. Thank the commissioners for coming forward. Ms. Berry, if you want to just begin by introducing yourself for the tape, and then what we'd like to do is to talk, to follow up a little bit from questions on the on your earlier presentation. We want to focus in a little bit on ANOCA to begin with in the Minnesota Security Hospital, since many of the questions that members had centered around those areas. But if you could please maybe just any other comments or things that you'd like to share regarding the earlier testimony or questions that you have to bring us up to speed, and then just kind of, if you want to just provide a bit of a sketch, a background sketch for ANOCA, we'll probably begin there. So with that, Commissioner Berry.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Ann Berry, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. My area of direct responsibility is the direct care and treatment programs, which includes all the programs where we are the direct service provider for people with mental illness, substance abuse issues, and serving people with developmental disabilities and other disabilities as well. I think the best place to start, I think overall, is to recapture what we've already testified to in front of the committee, is where the governor puts the resources into adding hospital and intensive rehabilitation services services for adults to relieve pressure at the ANOCA facility. So there are no specific governor's increases to the ANOCA facility. We're currently operating at about 100 beds at ANOCA, but we are feeling a great deal of pressure at the ANOCA facility because, for a variety of reasons. One is a change in the law from 2 years ago that required us to move people out of jails within 48 hours who had been committed to the commissioner. We always have to save beds for that reason. So a lot of pressure is being put on that system, and hospitals throughout the state are feeling the pressure that we are feeling at ANOCA. So to relieve some of that pressure at ANOCA, the governor's budget has included increases for three new facilities around the state who could take clients who are either at ANOCA and would need to be at ANOCA, or could go there without ever making the a trip to ANOCA first. So that's the complex conditions. I'm looking for the page here. But it's the proposal that would add beds for persons with complex conditions. It's on page 70 of your budget books. So there is no direct new resources for the ANOCA facility, but that proposal directly impacts the ANOCA facility.
And Ms. Berry, could you talk just a little bit about who the clientele is there and what the share might be for taking care of those folks from the county, how that relationship might work out at Anoka?
Mr. Chairman, on page 90 of your budget packages, there is a current breakdown of the share that counties pay when somebody comes to Anoka. And let me move to that page. So, for the first 30 days that somebody is placed in one of our facilities, there is no county share. From 31 to 60 days, there's a 20% county share. And then anything over 60 days is 75%. And it stays that way until the person is then either provisionally discharged or discharged into the community. The governor's budget would change that arrangement so that any time somebody came to us and did not need a hospital level of care, there would be 100% share from the day somebody came to us. So this current schedule is just doesn't recognize whether somebody even needs a hospital level of care or not. What we're finding is we're getting more and more people who do not need a hospital level of care. They're not always, but are often people who are coming to us from jail. And there's no front level assessment done when somebody comes to us under the 48-hour law. So sometimes they need a hospital level of care, sometimes they do not, but they're still coming to us. So what we're trying to do is to stem those people who are coming to us who do not need a hospital level of care, and the people who are in control of that are county, the courts and county attorneys who make those commitment petitions to the court to have somebody committed to the commissioner. So we think this will change the incentive so that people who do not need a hospital level of care will not be coming to Anoka.
Thank you, Commissioner. And one of the things that was brought up in the Ways and Means hearing was, I believe it was Representative Hackbarth in Ways and Means, who has a constituent suffered an injury as a result of an attack at that facility, and brought up certain safety concerns that he was made aware of by his constituents at that facility. We have had a lot of testimony and information regarding the State Security Hospital, but less so on this one. Could you bring us up to speed a little bit of what the state of the security issues are at Anoka, what is being addressed, and what has yet to be addressed?
Mr. Chairman, yesterday I was on the Anoka campus meeting with representatives from all of our labor units and unit staff and leadership of the hospital in much the same way that we worked with everybody at the security hospital. And used the abatement plan. I think I spoke about that last time I was in front of your committee, Mr. Chairman, that laid out what it is that labor believes we need to do to create a safe and therapeutic environment. We began that discussion yesterday. We've been in the discussion for a long time, but I think we got to a place yesterday where we could agree that there were a number of things that we can do without new resources at the Anoka facility, and that there are things that we would need that would require new resources. So one of the things, for example, that staff had asked for was security cameras like we have added down at the security hospital. You also know the current status of our budget, which is we are under a great deal of stress between now and the end of the year. We haven't made the request for security cameras on the unit, but we do think it's a really reasonable request from staff to create, again, a safer environment for everybody there. In addition to that, there was also a suggestion, a number of them that didn't cost us any resources. For example, getting upstream in the commitment process so that there was a front-end assessment about where a client should come. Right now, all of the clients who are coming from Dale are being committed as mentally ill. We think that with some intervention on the part of the department through the Attorney General's office, that some of those people might be committed to St. Peter, not to Anoka. Again, St. Peter is staffed and structured in a way to serve a higher acuity population and sometimes a more assaultive and threatening population. It's a program for people who are mentally ill and dangerous. So there are a number of things that we agreed we can do to mitigate what are people's concerns and really to create a safer environment. But some of those do require resources, so it's only been a day. I need to not only look at our budget, but consider what we might be able to do between now and the potential of another governor's budget.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Berry, I can't see you, but I know you're there. I wanted to go back to the proposal about the county 100% share for commitments and just ask you, who makes the determination of whether the person needs hospital-level care? And is that, it sounds like that's kind of after the fact, and it's made at Anoka, and then the county kind of just lives with that designation now under the proposal and has to pay 100%. It seems like there would, you know, not that anyone would do this on purpose, but it seems like there's an incentive there for the state to say, no, this person doesn't need 100%, doesn't need hospital level care. And then sort of the second part of that is, you know, we've got the 87 counties and they have very different levels of ability to take care of these issues. And what's your understanding of what resources they have and what they should be doing as an alternative?
Commissioner Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, the determination of who meets medical care is made at the hospital, is made by clinicians in the at either Security Hospital or at Anoka. But we think it makes sense for that to happen sooner in the process. In every commitment for somebody who is mentally ill, in all 87 counties, either a mental health practitioner or a mental health professional is responsible for the assessment to determine if, in fact, that person should be committed to the commissioner. It wouldn't be impossible nor difficult to add in another layer into that assessment, or a simple question, which would be, does this person require a hospital level of care? And if that question was asked at that point in time, we think that there would be at least 20 to 25% of the clients that are currently coming to Anoka now would not come, and maybe more. But there has to be a point at that early assessment where a determination is made about what level of service is required. Now, our limitation is we don't get involved until the person is already committed. So the commitment is completed. Sometimes we get information upstream, but most often the commitment is already done. We get a call, and the person is going to be transported to us within 48 hours. So because we're not part of the pre-hearing or pre-commitment process, we think that adding in that assessment would be the way to get at whether this person really needs a hospital level of care or not.
Thank you. And just kind of, oh, I'm sorry, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Assistant Commissioner Berry, or Deputy Commissioner Berry, on that point. You know, what I really would be useful, I think, for us to understand this is that it sounds like we're using some pretty blunt financial instruments to either try and kickstart the development of new services while at the same time penalizing counties before those are implemented, to see just kind of a flow chart, and maybe it's more process change is needed more than some of these, you know, sort of like we're going to start this and we're going to end this, we're going to impose this. And I don't see the orchestration, and maybe it's there behind the scenes, and maybe it's because they're in page by page. But I think that's why we're struggling to figure out what's the vision. And you've always described your system as the gap filler who will take people that the private sector won't take. And I'd really like to know, is there still going to be some gaps that counties and private providers don't feel like they have the ability to step up to? And as you're dealing with population pressures, you're trying to step away. And I think we all share a goal of kind of a seamless, logical, you know, most cost-effective system. And I think you've got some good steps here towards that, but it's just hard for me to envision how the pieces fit together.
Commissioner Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, there is no question that the only way that this system works to serve people is if counties, tribes, and the state all work together. And we're and one of the most important lessons, I think, for all of us were the unintended consequences that came from the 48-hour law. And just simply, we agreed, I think all agreed collectively, that people who have mental health issues should not sit in jail and wait for treatment. And we all, I think everybody collectively agreed, the legislature and the governor agreed, that there should be a path for that person to treatment. In creating that path to treatment, it became a new route right to Anoka and bypassed, you know, the entire rest of the system, and we saw real changes in commitment patterns across the state. And so one of the things I think we're trying to do and haven't done, I think, a good enough job of describing is, so how does this help balance out what was a system that was under stress before and can get back to being less stressed if we're only serving those people that we should need to serve at Anoka, and people who don't need to be served there can be served somewhere else. But I completely agree that that flow chart would not only chart state, county, tribal responsibilities, but how the money flows and who becomes responsible for the cost and what are the right incentives so that people get served where they should be served. I would be the first to say that it doesn't always feel like a partnership. It often feels like, you know, we make a change and then the county makes a change and then they, you know, and that's not serving anyone. So I'm not disagreeing at all with the statement you've just made, that part of this is getting the incentives aligned appropriately and recognizing that there are other places than just our high-level, very expensive hospitals to serve people who don't need them.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Deputy Commissioner Berry. I appreciate that, but I think we also need to pay as much attention to the back end, and you've noted in your narrative and your budget that it's just as hard to get people out once we've got them stabilized because we haven't done enough service development. And that's expensive and difficult. I mean, it's difficult for communities to step up. And the one thing I was concerned about your response to Chair Dean was the idea that, well, maybe some of these people should be going to, instead of to Anoka, to St. Peter. And once you put the mentally ill and dangerous label on them, you make it almost impossible for them, even after successful treatment, to be placed within a community. And in working, you noted that the decisions are often made by the county attorney and the sheriff or the, you know, whoever's in charge of the jail that just wants this person out, and they don't seem to fit and they do seem to have some mental health issues. I'm afraid that that system would step up much too quickly to label someone mentally ill and dangerous and then create perhaps lifelong challenges for the system upon their discharge if we don't do that part of it right. So I hope you'll look at that because I think it's that incentive to get rid of someone is at every step of the process.
Commissioner Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I agree the caution is another set of unintended consequences. But we do know that there are clients coming directly to us from jail on this more expedited route, who, if that path didn't exist, would probably be committed as mentally ill and dangerous by the county. And they are able to stop that process. So it there's no single answer to any of these problems. And I clearly hear your concern. It creates a whole different set of consequences for the system and for the person who's been committed.
Thank you, Commissioner Berry. And next, I think that might be a good transition to kind of move to the Minnesota Security Hospital and talk a little bit about that. we had moved through the deficiency funding for that facility, approving, I believe, 58 additional FTEs at that facility. And there was quite a bit of discussion around that and questions around that as that moved through. And I think there's some really legitimate questions about where we sit with that facility, with the additional monies that were put forward in the deficiency bill. Also, where we stand with the physical improvements through the capital investment work that has been done and is ongoing at that facility and moving forward. I think there's significant concern about the money being spent there and the allocation of resources relative to making this a safe facility for people to work at, and also the dollars that were deployed for that. One of the questions that I had following that was that as I looked at the allotment of new FTEs at that facility, there was, I believe the salary range for the FTEs was a band of hourly rates, and I believe it went up to $77 per hour. Could you just break down how many people we added at what levels and at what salary ranges that those were added within the deficiency bill?
Mr. Chairman, the positions that were added in the deficiency bill, the first 58 positions were unit staff, security counselors and unit staff. I could quickly find out what the range of salaries are for security counselors and unit staff. The next group of 15 that were added when more conditions were placed on our license, or the second condition came on the license, were higher level clinical staff. They were, we call them behavior medical practitioners. They have a higher salary range. One of the requirements of the set of the condition on our license was that we have coaches and mentors that are highly skilled and highly trained on the units. Originally, all three shifts, although we were able to work with licensing to remove the coaches and mentors from the overnight shift, but on day shift or early morning shift and afternoon, late afternoon shift, we have extra people who are highly skilled in working with person-centered thinking, trauma-informed care. They're generally clinicians, and they are working on the units with staff to not only point out where we're doing great work in engaging clients and understanding and building them toward recovery, and where we can make improvements with our staff. Those are more expensive staff than the first group of 58 that got added. I don't have a breakdown in front of me. There's one other group of staff that we've added in the last 2 years, and this has been a struggle, and I've been thrilled from a clinical perspective to be able to say we now have 4 forensic psychiatrists back on campus, but they are very expensive. I was just looking today at the salary ranges for our forensic psychiatrists, and they're in the range of they're over $250 an hour. So it's an expensive undertaking to run a forensic program. The state has obligated itself to that responsibility by having a forensic program. But so that was another additional cost to our program that's been added just in the last year. We are now fully staffed with forensic psychiatrists, but it's been at least 2 years since we have been. And I can get you, Mr. Chairman, and anyone who's interested, the ranges, if we can get those between now and the end of the committee hearing, we can certainly share the salary ranges.
Yeah, Commissioner Berry, that would be helpful, just a breakdown of the 58 additional employees, of what levels they were at and then what their salary ranges might be, and whether or not, I think the figure I saw was up to $77 an hour for the counselors. And is that an all-inclusive number that would include benefits, or is that just their wage? That would be helpful. And then also, does that include the issue of overtime? Particularly at that facility, has been an issue that has been brought up. that the overtime, and I had asked you about that in Ways and Means, about how much of the $10 million for additional staff was in overtime. And have we broken that out to see how much of that was actually directed towards overtime and how much towards frontline staff? And then moving forward, are we anticipating, are we building a model based on excessive overtime at that facility, or are we projecting moderate overtime within the salary ranges that you currently have?
Mr. Chairman, we've been keeping track of overtime in our system because one of the things we have been doing is reviewing every position to make a determination if we're going to add staff or not, and watching overtime to make sure that we're not driving more overtime by not adding staff. It wouldn't make any sense for us to do that. So we've been, every 2 weeks we look at overtime on the units, and then we do spot calls to the unit to see how many people are being inversed, which is, means they have to stay on another shift beyond the shift that they've been on, which we consider overtime as well. It turns out that overtime is actually going down in our facilities, including at the security hospital. What's happening at the security hospital, though, is we have a number of part-time and intermittent staff who were hired on a part-time basis who are now working something closer to full-time. So we have to fill hours. I mean, we have to have staff on the units. And so what's happening is we have staff that had never intended to work more than part-time being scheduled for almost full-time work. And that's not a position they want to be in, nor do we want to be in. So we were struggling with how to put numbers to the how much of the $10.4 million went toward overtime or part-time or intermittent staff working full-time schedules. And I think we're still working on that. I don't see anybody from HR here, but I'll catch somebody in a moment to see if we've actually put together the answer to that question.
Thank you, Commissioner Berry. Another question we had was, looking forward, are there any changes that you would expect relative to the conditional license that you have moving into the next year, either in the facility, the number of employees, or your operations at that facility? So is the census going to go up or down? The number of employees, are we anticipating more employees in the governor's budget? And any changes to the facility itself relative to the license that we have?
Mr. Chairman, I'll take them one at a time. I don't think our census will change dramatically. We've stayed around, I think, about between 350 and 390 for a number of years. We don't see big shifts because people who are committed to us are committed as mentally ill and dangerous, so we haven't seen big shifts in that population. So I don't think we'll see big census changes for our clients who are at Security Hospital. In terms of staffing, this governor's proposal just provides the foundation in 16 and 17 for what we requested in the deficiency bill. So the 73 staff that got added, the 58 unit staff, and then the 15 clinical staff are built into this proposal. So it's those additional 73 staff that are included in this proposal for 16 and 17 and the costs associated with them in the next biennium. And then the last piece, we're not going to do any more remodeling to the facility because we're currently reconstructing. We have started the bonding proposal that was passed in the last session. Construction has already started and some of the remodeling will be underway soon, and by this summer we will start to see some of those changes taking place on campus. So we did create the admissions unit. That was a $600,000 expenditure. We don't plan to create another unit or do any other remodeling of the building between now and the complete remodeling of the facility.
Thank you, Commissioner. And you know, we have had several issues surrounding that facility and security issues for the folks who are working there. Could you just remind us again, we said the census was not going to change, just where you've been numbers-wise over the last year for both total number of people, clients who are there, and on also employees, full-time employees, just so members can get an idea of how many people are live there, how many people work there, and then what the per diem rates are for that facility.
I have a cheat sheet behind me, but I'll try to do my best and then confirm. We have about 385 clients, and we have about 850 staff on the campus, on the Security Hospital campus. I would say that generally we think we have good staffing ratios when we are at full complement. We have both clinical staff and unit staff that have gone through a lot of training. We're seeing big changes in the use of restraint and seclusion. We had some concerns last year with an increase in injuries to staff. A number of them are attributable to one client where we've seen some huge changes in our program. But in fact, I want to say about 850 staff and about 375 to 85 clients. And that's the client number has been pretty steady. The staffing number jumped up by about 73 in the last year with the conditions on the license.
Thank you. Members, any other questions for Commissioner Berry? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I have a question. It's not in particular of the details in which our chairman spoke to, but it regards the governor's budget. And just on page 90, just regarding the program, it lists out the fiscal years going out to 2019, but doesn't have any data for the past 2 years or even 4 years. And I just think it would be beneficial, I would presume anyway, safely, that it would be beneficial to us as lawmakers here to look to the past as what we have done to see the increase or decrease on any one number of these services or programs. So I just challenge you, it's not a question, you certainly can comment if you desire to, but it's a comment that I think would be helpful. I actually mentioned it last year as well. I think it'd be helpful for all in the room as we look past the past going into the future as to where the budgets were and where they are going. And going back even four years would be adequate.
Commissioner Berry.
Mr. Chairman, we do have the data that would show the non-acute bed days much further back than fiscal year 13, and we can certainly go back to 2010 or 11, and I think that would actually then show us changes in law to the 48-hour rule. You would see what effect it might have as well. So yes, we can certainly go back farther than what's included on this budget page.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Commissioner Berry. If one of the patients, I think I'm referring to them correctly, injures one of the staff members, and let's just say it's defined as a felony, does he get charged with that and has the potential to go to prison for it? Or does, what happens if one of the patients commits a crime against staff members? How is that handled?
Commissioner Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, this is a question we get quite often. There's a difference between our direct care and treatment programs. In the sex offender treatment program, if one of the clients there commits a felony and it is charged by the county attorney, we don't have control over whether the county attorney will charge that or not, but if they are charged, then that client would return to corrections and serve time there. We have something different in our treatment programs, and it really depends on the county in which we're located. If a staff person is assaulted, maybe at St. Peter, that there would be a determination that would be made by the county as to whether to charge for that assault. The same is true whether it's at Anoka. The chairman talked about an assault that took place at the Anoka facility. The staff person wanted to press charges, did, and it was up to then, in this case, the city because of the level of the charges. The city has to make the determination whether to bring the charges or not. So it's outside of our control, but there is nothing that prevents a staff person from advancing charges or, you know, ask. Generally what happens are the police come to campus, and at that point in time, if, you know, if they're called, and whether it's in the Anoka situation or any of our other facilities, the police are called, and then it's up to the county or city attorney to determine if charges are going to be made or not. We are in the position, though, of treating people who have been committed to us who are either mentally ill or mentally ill and dangerous, and many of them come to us because they have crimes. And so the real question is where would they continue to get their treatment? Probably back with us. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that are made that are part of that consideration, but I have seen in some of the most serious assaults that the county has charged, and we have had clients who have gone to jail.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for that response, Commissioner Berry. So in the last 5 years, how many clients who have assaulted staff have actually gone back to corrections? If you can just give me a guesstimate or approximate.
Commissioner Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I'd have to follow up because I don't have that information immediately in front of me. And I don't have a gauge for that either.
Thank you, Commissioner. That would be great if we could follow up with that. And also, I think there was the incident at the Minnesota Security Hospital last year where there was a murder that took place, and we've kind of covered that in the conditional license and the things that were brought forward in the deficiency bill. But also concerns remain about the security of staff as well as the folks living there moving forward even within the deficiency request, and how that overlaid with the deficiencies that were noted in the license. Some concerns about that, and those concerns will continue as we move forward. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, just a question as we talk about staff safety. What kind of liability, whether it's liability insurance or anything, what kind of costs is incurred that the state has to carry in case something does happen to a staff person? I would imagine if they had lifelong injuries or disabilities or, you know, any type of thing, or, you know, against lawsuit, what kind of liability is there, and what investment is made into that for those protections, both for the state and the security hospital? Just wondering what those numbers look like and the kind of money involved with that.
Commissioner Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, the state is self-insured for workers' compensation. All of our employees are eligible for workers' compensation. We carry large liability as a result of workers' compensation costs in our programs across all of direct care and treatment, and we can share with you those costs and what they've been historically and what they are today. We have staff who are disabled enough or hurt enough that they can't return to their old jobs, so we find other jobs that they can do if they can't work back on a unit again because of the injury they sustained. But we do, we have workers' compensation coverage, and we do have high costs in workers' compensation.
Thank you. Members, do we have any other questions for Commissioner Berry on direct care and treatment? And if not, we're going to move on to the next commissioner, but I want to just give members any other an opportunity to ask Ms. Berry any other questions if we have them. Seeing none, if we could have Commissioner DeCabelius come forward from Community Services. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And if you could just, Commissioner, if we could please, we're going to be we had some follow-up questions about the Wilmer facility that we'd like to ask some questions about in specific. But if you want to, if you would please just maybe give a background of a couple of minutes about that facility and just kind of where we are moving into that. That's the primary reason for the discussion today. So if you want to maybe just set the context and pick up where you left off from the last discussion, that would be great.
Mr. Chair, members, Jennifer DiCubellis, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Human Services, Community Support specifically. Mr. Chair, if the question is on the Wilmer facility, I can respond to the services and supports that we are working to develop in the community in response to that, but if it's specific to the Wilmer facility, I would defer to Deputy Commissioner Berry.
All right. Why don't you perhaps just set the context for that, and then maybe if Ms. Berry could come back up, we could address questions to both of you. That would be great. Thank you. Please continue.
Mr. Chair, members, what we're working on in the policy side in mental health is the creation of the PRTFs, the psychiatric residential treatment facilities. So we are looking at some alternative levels for individuals, for youth in our community. We have heard clearly from families and stakeholders that our youth that have highly aggressive behaviors don't often have a place to get the treatment that they need because of the system gaps that we have. And one of the proposals you have in front of you on item 62 in your books is the psychiatric residential treatment facilities, where we are looking to bring on new capacity for those highly aggressive behaviors, individuals where inpatient services may not meet the needs, but also our residential services aren't staffed appropriately. And so it is a new level of care that we have a proposal going forward on. That is also inclusive of the population that is currently being served at Wilmer.
All right. Perhaps if Commissioner Berry would come forward and maybe just set up the specific circumstances around Wilmer, that would be helpful for us. If you could perhaps just walk through the decision points around the closure of that facility, maybe going back a year and bringing us up to the budget point, that would be great.
Mr. Chairman, yes. There were a number of things that were happening simultaneously. One was, the policy division of the department had undergone a process of studying children's mental health services across the state and had a number of stakeholder meetings across the state and had engaged and invited us to those discussions. As a part of that discussion, what became clear was the lack of geographic spread of services for people, for children who needed special hospitalization services and other levels of services. And then we heard from parents and families and advocates about the one place in the state where we do provide this level of service isn't always easy for families to get to, that in fact Wilmer is a great location for the central part of the state, but a lot of the children that are being committed to our program are coming from the metropolitan area and from other parts of the state. So it was making it difficult for families to be part of their children's treatment. So we heard those things. There was also probably about 7 months ago, we had a client in our program, and without sharing a lot of private information, who destroyed one of the units completely, so it made it unusable for a long period of time. And having been to the facility numerous times and listened to staff talk about operating a program on two separate floors and new treatment facilities today don't look like this treatment facility looks like, we started to put all these things together and say, so what's the future of the Wilmer Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services program, and what would a system look like in the state of Minnesota if it were to serve people and, I mean, families and their children closer to their homes at a level of care that they specifically needed, and reached the conclusion, I think, in concert with the policy division, that over time we could close the Wilmer facility and replace it with using contracted hospital beds for children who needed a hospital level of care, and the creation of the psychiatric residential treatment facilities for children who didn't need a hospital level of care. So it really, really was an evolution in the way we provide services to children, with a central theme being where those children come from and where is their support system.
Thank you, Commissioner Berry. And yesterday we had testimony from some folks who spoke against the closure and were big fans talking about that. And this has been discussed not just this year but for several years. But the decision was made to close the facility by Governor Dayton this year. Could you tell us what month that decision came?
The decision to close the facility is part of the governor's budget. So it right now we're at about five clients, and we're holding at five clients. We probably could take more than five clients, although our census has never really gone above eight or ten. But I would say that the decision to close will not happen until the legislature completes its work. So it is part of the governor's budget. It is what he is advancing in his budget, but there is the facility hasn't closed. I'm not sure if I understand the question.
Yes, Commissioner. For example, 2 years ago, we were in a similar budget situation with a very similar census at that facility. Obviously, the conditions of the facility were renovated, from what I understand in testimony yesterday, in 1998. So the facilities have not changed dramatically over the last 2 years. The census has not changed from 2 years ago, from the last budget cycle to this cycle. So I'm just wondering at what decision point there was that was made, or if that's just a creation of this year's budget.
Mr. Chairman, this is a mix of both service delivery and policy decision. I think that the policy division, and now led by Assistant Commissioner DeCabellis, reached the conclusion that there are other ways to serve this population, and other states are serving this population of children in a very different kind of way, and Minnesota could do the same thing. That emerged at about the same time we began, to for a long time admire the limitations that we had in the program at Willmar. I would never suggest that. In fact, I've hopefully clearly sent the message to staff at Willmar that they are a highly skilled, highly trained group of people who have delivered service to a very, very difficult population. And having been on the other side of, working in a state hospital that closed and listening to somebody from St. Paul try to explain to me why the program was closing, I understood the perspective they have. This is not about who they are and who they're serving and the job they've done serving them. It's just that I think we can serve this population in a different way going forward. And I think that came very, that same position comes from the policy division, advocates, families, and other states who have done this differently.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the commissioner. When you talk about having the patients closer to the families, I can understand that. With that said, when you're asking this to be relocated to the metro area, what consideration are you giving to the families who are located out in rural Minnesota? Where's the thought process there? Where's the concern for the families out in rural areas?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I think that's what works about this proposal, is that we would use hospital contract beds for children who need hospital level of care. And the governor's proposal, which I really need to let Assistant Commissioner DeCabellis talk about, really geographically spreads services across the entire state. And I should probably turn it over to her at this point. But it changes the delivery system in such a way that we can spread services across the entire state and be close to children wherever they are.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hampton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I asked a couple questions yesterday about the current facility. I think you touched on this, but I want you to reiterate once again. Tell us about the type of care, or whether or not the care is of quality currently, and are they competing with the local hospitals?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, they're not competing with local hospitals, and I think our staff are terrific. I think you heard from Dr. George Realmuto, who's an expert in, and also holds a professor position at the University of Minnesota. He has expertise in child and adolescent health health needs, special health needs. We have a terrific staff. This is not about the quality of our staff. They are serving a very difficult population. But as certainly as somebody who has worked in a facility and has visited the facility enough, if we could design something, it probably wouldn't look like the facility we're currently operating in today.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the facility today, is there anything that we can be doing to that facility to, to make it more appealing in your eyes or the decision maker's eyes, to where we could still have this service, this care, or even use the facility that's existing currently?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I think that's among a set of choices about how we spend bonding resources. It's part of the old Wilmer campus. So, if for any of you are familiar with them, it's the tile walls, very narrow hallways, two-story, a lot of blind stairways. We design treatment programs and facilities different today. That's all. And it's a very old structure that was remodeled in the late 90s. But you can only do so much with structures that were that well built, and in the time frame in which they were built.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Berry, a couple things were raised when we heard testimony about this, I think, yesterday. And one, there was an allegation that the reason that the census is low at the Wilmer facility is because it's been capped at some low level. And I wanted you to respond to that allegation. I think that the testifier was saying this was an artificially low census. And the second thing I wanted you to address is we heard some pretty compelling testimony from a mother of children who have been treated there, who was just adamant that this was the only place that was able to successfully deal with her children's situations. And she had a number of adopted children who had extremely severe issues, and she was really just pretty much raving about the care they'd received there, and she said she'd been everywhere else and nobody else could do what they did at the Wilmer facility. So she was, of course, just was very compelling and was just really distressed that facility was going to be closed. So I wonder if you could respond to both of those things.
Commissioner Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, the census for the facility in the last 2 years has been anywhere between 8 and 10 clients. We're currently at 5 clients. In fact, today I think we might be at 6. But we're right around 5 clients. And the reason is we're doing a number of things. One, we're trying to manage a pretty serious budget shortfall, so we can add a lot of staff at our facilities. We're now engaged in this budget discussion about what happens next with the facility. So right now we are at 5 clients with a waiting list. I think I looked at it earlier today. I think we have 3 or 4 people on the waiting list. So we have capped the facility at 5 clients, but we haven't been above 8, as I said, 8 or 10 clients for the last 2 years. And I'm sorry, I didn't hear the testimony from the mother. It's always wonderful and gratifying to hear what a great job our staff are doing, because they do remarkable work. They, not just at our facility in Wilmer, but across our system, they deal with some of the most challenging and see wonderful results in our program. We don't often hear that, so I'm going to go back and take a listen. But I think even more importantly, there probably weren't a lot of places for that parent to take her child. There probably today, unless we very specifically carve out an arrangement for a hospital to take children who need this level of care, the governor's budget, we won't be successful in advancing this governor's budget proposal. So what we have to do is to find another contract arrangement, because the rest of the hospital systems of the world can't carve out this kind of space for a group of children who have this level of need. But what we think is included in this proposal is a route forward, so that we could do that and at the same time provide this next level of care. So I don't doubt that this parent couldn't find anything else when she at the time that she was looking. What we're suggesting is there's a different way forward.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Berry. I appreciate that, but I I'd love to hear a conversation between this mom and you, because she really needs assurance, and I think we all probably need assurance that the kind of care that's available there that her children receive is still going to be available. I mean, that's really, she really gave me pause with her testimony about whether we're doing the right thing, and I just hate to have us take something that isn't broken and really break it. And I understand the concern about having the other care more available throughout the state. I think that's absolutely right on. But, you know, the very, very specialized stuff has to be someplace. And I just would hate to have us break up a good thing that we've got going. So when you watch that testimony, I'd really love to hear sort of your specific response to, you know, where this same level and this same quality of care would be found after we would close this facility.
Thank you, Commissioner Berry. One of the things that you had said, I just want to follow up on, you had said that actually that the limitation is perhaps on staff availability in your budget and not necessarily beds. Is there currently a wait list for this facility?
Mr. Chairman, we have wait lists for all our facility, and I think today's census, I think there were three clients waiting, children waiting services. Wait lists can be deceiving because they're probably looking for other places, and children get waitlisted in a number of different places, but I think that was the number today.
Thank you, Commissioner Berry. So if we were to go to the Capital Investment Committee today and immediately come up with a large amount of money and build, improve the facility and add beds at that facility, you would be in exactly the same position that you're currently in. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I understand the question. We're licensed as a 16-bed facility, so the most children we could take is 16. Our census has been around 8 or 10. So we could take we're staffed to take more than the 5 children we have right now, but we could take up to 8 to 10 children, I think, in our program today. I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, I think many folks of us hear the testimony that we're short on beds and we need to find people, we need to find places for people in need around the state of Minnesota. And here we see that we've got a facility that was in Willmar, Minnesota, that is slated to be closed because we have unavailable resources and the facility is deficient. But in fact, we have a wait list for this facility and there's less than 10 people there. I just think that that's good for the committee members to know. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the statements made yesterday, and if staff remembers the statement about, was it there was going to be somebody made a statement about a possible gap in providing care when the facility would be closed to when these other facilities would be opened. Can you give me some enlightenment on that issue?
Commissioner Berry. Commissioner DeCabellis.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Schoen, to your point, that is why we are attached at the hip on these proposals, is to make sure that we've got something to receive the individuals. We are very cognizant of the critical needs of families and the youth that we serve and needing to make sure that those options are in place prior to a closure. We are working with community providers right now to see where is there capacity that currently exists or is there new capacity that we can develop in order to close that gap.
Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair, Assistant Commissioner, so do you have identified areas, and I understand that there's contract, they're planning to do contracts with hospitals, and I mean, I know that we have the absolute utmost difficulty taking a juvenile off the street today who's in a crisis and finding them a bed in a juvenile psychiatric facility or somebody that does mental health care in the hospitals that we have right now. So how does this proposal, how are we going to find more beds that we don't have right now in hospitals? And then, well, I'll answer, if you can, I'll stop there, and then I have a follow-up with the other part.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, members, we are in discussions with trying to add some new capacity to new beds. So we have clearly heard the concern that individuals say there aren't, there isn't a lot of capacity. We do believe there is some flow that we could do with some funding to get these youth where they need to be. But we do believe that we can create some new capacity as well in some of those facilities.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Schoen.
An assistant commissioner. So then are you in talks with Rice Memorial Hospital in Willmar and Fergus Falls, or who are the hospitals? Because this is, I mean, am I mistaken, but, I mean, juvenile mental health is even a bigger specialty than your typical, because we are shipping people all over the state from one end to the other. I mean, you'll have somebody that we bring to United or Children's or any facility, and then the only bed available is at Rice Memorial or Fergus Falls. And even though their family's here, they still have to get shipped clear across the state because of availability. So, I'm understanding of the concept to be closer, but I'm also cognizant of, you know, cities that have had these facilities over the years, like Willmar, Fergus Falls, Sauk Center, other places where, I mean, these were a source of jobs, and then, I mean, we closed them down to nothing. And so that's one part of it, and then the availability of what they did. And I understand that over the years it's difficult. What about the houses then, and where are you going to go? I mean, so now what do they look like? This is a, like, I don't want to say halfway house, or but it's a residential facility. And that's with a contract of a specific group. Will they be? Will it be multiple groups? Or are we trying to identify one specific company to move out into all over the state to do this?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members, let me make sure I've got all of the different questions that were in there, Representative Schoen. So who are we working with specifically? We've been working through the Minnesota Hospital Association to identify where is their existing capacity and where is their interest that we could create some new capacity. We absolutely, to your point, are looking for geographic accessibility. So how can we make sure that we're not just in the metro? If we can get to some rural areas, we absolutely would hope to do that. But it's early in those discussions to define that. I think you asked also about the models. And so in the proposal is two different models. One is those extending some contract beds in our hospitals for extended stays. So some of these youth don't fit in the quicker turnaround of acute care. So having some extended day beds, looking at a capacity of adding 30 if we could. Is one goal, and the other, the PRTFs, the Psychiatric Residential Treatment Facilities, are the one option we have is those are IMD excluded, so they don't hit against that 16-bed limit, and it also allows us to draw Medicaid funding. So that is critical in order to create some geographic reach and some capacity when it's not state funding alone, that we can draw down that additional funds. Those facilities, we have a lot of room to, within the federal statutes, to define what they look like and geographically where we need them and what size we need them at. So those are discussions, if this proposal moves forward, that we need to have.
Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair and Mrs. Assistant Commissioner, when would the closing date be effective? And is there, in that range, do you foresee, what's the contingency if you can't find placement when it closes? And then if it's the 5 to 10 range kids in Willmar, what kind of care will those 5 to 10 kids need that are in that facility right now? And will it vary from needing the hospital care to the residential treatment? Can you give us some idea of what the needs might be there with that 5 to 10 on a typical census day?
Commissioner DeCapellis.
Mr. Chair, representatives, so the timing is we do believe we could get some contract beds up by this fall. Clearly, we need to make sure that the 5 to 6 individual that we've at least met that capacity, if not being able to extend it beyond that. The PRTFs, because it is a new benefit set and a federal requirement, may take longer to bring up if the proposal is approved. But the stopgap is to make sure that at least those contracted beds to meet those unique needs are immediately available.
Representative Schoen.
Well, sorry. So then the plan is if it takes longer to get the residential set, or if a juvenile would qualify or meet the needs for the CABS, then now they would go to a hospital? Is that the plan? In between, even if they were more geared for what we want to be the physical or the residential setting?
Commissioner DeCapellis.
Mr. Chair, members, they would go into an extended contract bed in the short run.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a few more questions, I guess, a series of questions. You talk about this, and I want to come back to that one. Help me understand the new capacity development. Will these new areas, I hear a lot about Hope, May, Seek, we do believe, we're in talks and negotiations. In these new developments, will they be coming back to the legislature asking for money in order to accommodate the needs for the patients? And what kind of costs would that be?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, representatives, our understanding is that the facilities believe they can do it within the cost structure that we have existing through our MA funding and our inpatient contract bed utilization currently. So my understanding is that we would not need additional funding, but I think as we get further into those discussions around staffing, that will be more clear.
So, Mr. Chairman, so we're not guaranteed on that. We don't know. And we don't know for sure where they're going to be located. And you said in the opening comments, too, that we're trying to get the people in the care closer to the families. I live in Mountain Lake. Will you have a facility in or around Mountain Lake, for instance?
Commissioner DeCapellis.
Mr. Chair, members, I can't speak to any specific locations, but we absolutely are looking to see if we can get a geographic reach for those contract beds.
And, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hamilton.
You're talking about one of the issues with the facility, that it was multiple level. Are you guaranteeing us here that the new facilities will not be multiple level, that they will be single level facilities? Is that a guarantee?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members, what we will make sure is that it's a clinically appropriate facility.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamilton.
What would we need to do at the Wilmer facility, again, to make it clinically appropriate, I think is the terminology. What would we need to do there? And my last question was your answer in that. What is broken? What are we missing at the Wilmer facility? Are you telling us that the children in their care are not receiving the quality of care? Is that what we're hearing?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, to your first question, we'd need to widen the hallways probably a good 5 to 6 feet. We'd have to increase the size of the bedrooms at each level. We'd have to have more recreational space, both indoors and outdoors. We'd probably have to have some more schoolroom space. There's just a number of things that if we could start from scratch, there's just a number of things that we would do to that building. There's really poor sight lines as well. So when you're working on a unit, you should be able to at least one place on the unit be able to see the entirety of the unit. It's one of the issues we're trying to address at the security hospital as well. And when we update that facility, we'll be able to do so. But right now at Wilmer, we've had to use security cameras and corner mirrors. I don't know if we're using corner mirrors, but we've had to use other strategies to get sight lines so that we can see and hear all the clients on our units. It's more work for our staff. And if we could, again, were using a facility that was part of the institution that was the Wilmer Regional Treatment Center. They were built for a purpose when they were built in the early part of the century, and then in the 50s and 60s and remodeled, and they're older structures, and even though we've remodeled them, it would take some work to design it like new treatment facilities are designed today.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the testifiers, then, one, is the staff then asking, since it's more work for the staff, is the staff asking for this to be closed? And two, once again, what are we missing as far as quality care for the people that are there? Are they receiving quality of care? Are they making this thing work?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I think our staff are highly trained. I think they're doing an extremely good job in difficult circumstances. I would say that not every client we've served there has had the result that we wanted, but there are clearly plenty of clients who are served in the program, children and their families, who are extremely satisfied and happy with the service. I think it's also a very expensive way for the state to deliver service. Even if our census was at 10 clients, the appropriation, it's all state dollars, or state appropriation is about $5 million. It's a very, very expensive program, the way it's currently operated. Some of that is because we have to have staffing models that fit with the building we have. So, as I said, I completely understand the staffing point of view. Having been on the other side of this, I understand when programs change and best practices change and treatment environments change, everything changes. And I know our staff are feeling that. I understand that. This is not about our staff or their skill set.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you're here guaranteeing us that they're not going to be asking for any additional money to help the facilities that you may seek or you may find. They're not going to be back here asking for additional funding from the legislature. You're guaranteeing us what Representative Schoen had said, there will not be a gap on finding places for these families. You're guaranteeing us that these will have options that will have these patients closer to our families. These are all guarantees that you're making, and you're guaranteeing us that it's going to be less dollars as a state to provide the same quality of service?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I've been around a long time working in this system, and guarantees are very almost impossible to make. If we're not ready to close the facility in Wilmer, we won't close the facility. If we can't find alternatives that provide the same level of service to meet the needs of children and families, we won't close the facility. And this proposal, like other parts of the governor's budget, are a way for us to evolve service delivery. And if we find that there is not a contract provider out there who's willing to take children and willing to take the commitment that comes with it, by the way, these are all children who are committed to the commissioner. If they're not willing to take that, well, then we can't close down the program.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I think that you brought up a very good point in just talking about the program and policy change of moving the facility out of Wilmer versus the physical needs of the building itself and how that relates to staffing. And you have kind of an ideal or best practice that your wish list that you had have if you designed from scratch versus the building that you currently hold a license for versus the building you hold a conditional license for or a variance. Is there currently limitations placed on your license based on the building itself?
Mr. Chairman, I'll have to follow up to see if we have any variances. We're licensed by, I believe, both health and DHS, and then we're also accredited by the Joint Accreditation of Hospitals. I will check to see if we have any variances.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I think we and whether or not, I mean, obviously you're currently operating, so you're operating legally within your license. We know that to be true, so that you are currently in compliance with the laws of the state of Minnesota for your facility and your management of the facility. But we would like to follow up to see if there's any conditional uses that are placed on that or limitations on the facility. We're assuming that the building is up to code, in other words. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to follow up with something about a contract with an agency or an organization. Would there exist a potential that an organization would be, if they enter into an agreement to take juveniles, if they so choose to do so, does that mean they cannot refuse any of them? If they say, we will be those facilities that enter into a contract with the state, that is there the potential for such a difficult case that they would say, sorry, come pick him or her up, we're not going to continue to care? I just want to clarify that.
Thank you, Representative Schoen. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we're both nodding our heads. We've had this conversation over and over again for the last few months. One of the conditions has to be that these are people committed to the commissioner. If we are giving up our capacity to serve this population, we will not have capacity to serve this population. And whoever takes on this responsibility doesn't get to demit or not accept anyone that we would otherwise accept, because that's the condition under which we provide the service. So that has been a long-standing discussion between us and is clearly an understanding that we have.
Thank you, Commissioner. And one of the, just the last question on this, and then we're going to move on. The average length of stay at Wilmer, and then whether or not the hospitals are able to absorb the length of stay and the placement of that. If you could address that, if you know that now.
Mr. Chairman, I'll get you the information on the length of stay and provide it to you and for committee members. I think one of the biggest differences in this program is the length of stay. We have children who stay with us a long period of time, months. We just discharged somebody. They're in transition to Security Hospital and now on their way to the community, but they were with us for almost 2 years. So there are people with children with extraordinarily long length of stay, and so we would that's why it's a very expensive service as well. So one of the things that we need to be able to do is to look at the rate that we're paying, because most hospitals don't have length of stay that look anything like that length of stay.
Thank you, Commissioner. We do appreciate you coming back today for additional questions, and I think that shed a lot of light on all three of those facilities. So we do appreciate you coming back and both of you spending time with the committee today. Let's see. Is there any other questions for Commissioner DeCavalis before we let her go?
Well,
thank you so much, Commissioner. We really do appreciate your time today. And if next up, if we could have Commissioner Koppel, please come on down. Commissioner, we're going to be discussing some of the children family services programs that we had discussed a little bit earlier. Some members had questions, particularly around the Parent Aware program. Could you, if you could, please just kind of set up that discussion of where we left it off and what the governor has intended moving forward? This is a big change portion of the governor's budget and an initiative of the governor's. Could you just enlighten the committee on where we left off and kind of highlight that, if you could, from the governor's standpoint for the upcoming budget?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services. So the Parent Aware budget item in the governor's budget reflects the efforts that this state has made and the department has made in a quality improvement, quality design for our child care system and for our scholarship program. The Parent Aware grew out of the Race to the Top funds that we received, and along with our child care block grant or development funds, we've also used some funding there to develop a system where we have a quality rating system. Federal law requires states to have a quality system for child care. We chose to use this system and developed that under our Race to the Top funding. So the funds end at the end of this year, calendar year 15, the Race to the Top funds. The amount of money that the governor has in the budget replaces some of those Race to the Top funds so that we can maintain the quality improvements that we made in the number of homes and centers and those programs receiving scholarship dollars can continue to be rated under our quality rating system. I'll start there. And
yes, thank you, Commissioner. And if you could just talk about how does the CCAP affect the higher reimbursement directly for the facilities? Could you talk a little bit about that and just kind of draw the link of how that money works?
So our child care assistance program has a reimbursement level. If a facility is has a 3 or 4 star rated system under Parent Aware, they would receive a 20% increase in reimbursement under the CCAP program. Does that answer your question, Mr. Chair?
Yes, if you could, just about just the dollars that you have available within the budget currently within the governor's budget. And maybe if you have a reference point to members for the booklet, and if you don't, that's okay too.
Mr. Chair, I unfortunately did not bring my
okay
to give you the page number.
That's okay. And do you anticipate any other federal funding for this, Commissioner?
That is unclear. There is a block grant that has to go through appropriation process. There are, in addition to the funds we receive now, there have been in the last go-around of the federal legislation increased regulation requirements that have been placed on the state as well. So, for instance, one of them being that we visit facilities once a year versus every 2 years for licensure, unrelated to Parent Aware, just in terms of licensure. So that's, some of that is going to require more funding. So if there is more funding, which we're not sure of, there are also additional requirements that would go with that funding.
Thanks. And could you talk a little bit about the copay requirement and if universal pre-K is free and offered by a school district, what happens with that copay?
Mr. Chair, that's not entirely clear to us. What I can tell you how the program operates now, and that is that the copay is paid to the child care provider, is collected by the child care provider and paid to the child care provider by the family. So that is how the program works. And so there is a year of planning year ahead that I believe is associated with the universal pre-K program, and those would be need to be worked out in terms of whether or not a universal pre-K program would qualify for or receive any of that copay. I think that has not been clarified.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Commissioner, of course, you didn't initiate this program, so by all means, I'm not going to beat you up for it. But I've always wondered the effect that Parent Aware had in early childhood education in the last 4 years that have been involved. And knowing we have a huge achievement gap at the end of the student's life, and a huge problem with graduation, and then 40% of students who graduate, who go on to college, have to take remedial courses at the cost of $18 million to those students here in Minnesota. So I think, I suspect, we might be putting too much emphasis on the early childhood. I just suspect, I'm not saying it's a fact, I just suspect, just looking at the outcome. Now, the governor proposes and says that decades of research supports that early childhood education yields good students. Decades. That's 20 years, maybe longer. But yet the evidence doesn't show that. Now, the definition of kindergarten in Wikipedia says this. And just also, the Parent Aware passed this out yesterday, and they say that Minnesota kids starting kindergarten are behind and not catching up. Now, I remember kindergarten. Mrs. Rigg was my teacher, and boy, I sure liked her a lot. She was great. I didn't start kindergarten until I was 6. Back in the 70s, usually I started when I was 5. But my mom said I was so cute, she wanted to keep me home another year. Reality was I was a little short, and she didn't want me to get beat up. But here's what it says about kindergarten. Is a preschool educational approach traditionally based around playing, singing, practical activities such as drawing, and social interaction as a part of the transition from home to school. The first such institutions were created in the late 18th century in Bavaria and Strasbourg to children whose both parents worked out of the home. So we know it was a good program. Prior to kindergarten, you had first grade, first through 12. So here now we have a program that teaches kids to sing and play and dance and interact with one another, tie their shoe, pick out colors. And yet we spend so much time, and that's kindergarten. And I remember my first term here listening to the Secretary of Education, the commissioner maybe it was, said that kindergarten was for the sole purpose of being able to navigate the hallways and be social with your classmates and learn singing and dancing. But yet we spend so much money on Parent Aware to get them prepared for kindergarten so they are prepared to sing and dance and navigate the hallway. And yet the evidence I submit to you is not clear enough when you consider the gap that we have at the end. 40% of students who take college have to do remedial courses. Folks, did you hear that? 40%. $18 million. And guess what? Of those proportions, they're not graduating. They end up after 2 years dropping out of college because they said, why am I going in debt when I should have learned this in high school? And then we're preparing students that don't even have a skill, barely. We have a huge skills gap in our country. And yet we want to spend millions and millions of dollars for kids to prepare them for kindergarten. Now, I know it's more complex than that, and I use a little theatrics, but in kindergarten, you learn to sing and dance and play and count your numbers and do more important things than that. I understand that. I'm not trying to be funny here. But we have a serious gap, and I think we just should be careful not to put too much emphasis on pre-K when we need to get them prepared for college and for life skills. I didn't form that in a question, though, Commissioner Koppel, but certainly would be lovely to hear from you if you wanted to.
What was your teacher's name again?
Mrs. Rigg.
Mrs. Rigg,
yeah.
All right. In Watertown, Mr. Maine. You're free to pick up where Miss Rigg left off. Or
now, that's not funny.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, so just to be clear, I'm going to hone in just on one element of what you were talking about. the parent aware program is not the universal pre-K, is not associated with the universal pre-K program. That's a separate initiative in the governor's budget. So when the question was asked about how our child care assistance co-pays would interact with the universal pre-K, it was just it was trying to see if there was a linkage between what we pay now for child care and the co-pays that parents pay as part of the assistance program. You know, the state subsidizes a portion, and then depending on family size and income, the family pays a portion. And what would happen to those families if they then were not in child care, but instead were going to if we had a universal pre-K program, what would the co-pay be in that instance? So this, I just wanted to be clear what that the child care, and the answer to that question is, after I made it this long, is I'm not sure. however, that's what we were talking about in particular, were those co-pays in child care. And we do believe, from a CCAP vantage point, the amount of money we spend in child care is very important for two reasons. One, to give the child a quality early childhood experience, which includes playing and socializing, getting ready to learn when they do go to kindergarten, but also it's a work support for parents, and in particular those not just low income, but those coming out of our MFIP program and into work. And we think it's very important, work support, that parents have this and are able to get to work on in a predictable way. So that's the reason we put that money into the CCAP program.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I think Representative McDonald brings up a good point. Within the governor's budget, there's a very clear policy change of bringing pre-K and perhaps daycare into the schools. That's an initiative. That's a policy that was put out there. And where that line is, we're going to have to kind of decide. And as parents let their kids go a little earlier to school, that's a policy decision that has a lot of cost to it. It also has a lot of ramifications to our educational system. So we certainly understand that and would see where Representative McDonald is coming from. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just quickly, I wanted to follow up on a couple of Representative McDonald's statements. Wikipedia is one option for getting information. I'm going to open up Mommypedia now because I just had a child who finished kindergarten, graduated from kindergarten, wore his cap, and I'll tell you, he didn't learn how to sing and dance and play games and navigate halls. He learned how to read. He learned how to write. He learned how to do math. Much more complex things than what you were doing in Mrs. Riggs' class or I was doing in Mrs. Berg's class. Having those kids all show up ready to learn to read, ready to learn to write, ready to learn is of vital importance, and that's what these kinds of investments get at. Your statistics about outcomes, I think, are really significant and really important, and what they show is that we have failed to invest in pre-K in our state and around the country. We had a group of CEOs that joined together several years ago based on the research that came out of the Federal Reserve Board, that you got a 16-to-1 return on your investment in early childhood education, and they failed to push the legislature to make this investment, push our state to make this investment, and it wasn't for lack of trying. They were very committed to it because they wanted a workforce that they were going to be able to pick the best and the brightest from our state. Yesterday I was in the Education Finance Committee, and we were talking about early childhood learning and just one aspect of this, and we invest from HHS, we invest in this, these programs in education as well. And school readiness programs in our state started getting funding in 1991. There has been no significant increase in that funding since 1991. Last legislative session, we got them additional $8 million. but the need has grown tremendously. The populations have grown tremendously, and we haven't funded it. So while I think you bring up excellent points about what outcomes we're getting, I really feel strongly that it's not because of the investment we've made in early childhood. It's because of the lack of investment we've made.
Thank you. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi, Mr. Koppel. How are you?
Fine. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Good.
Fine.
sometimes we have to ask the commissioners exactly how they're feeling, too. So I've got a question for you. First off, I think I must have left some of the information you gave me regarding the number of providers over the last 10 years per county who have no longer, you know, the number that you showed me from the last 10 years that significantly declined the number of providers that we have lost over 10 years. So if you could give me that back, that information, that would be helpful. I think I must have left it in committee and got trashed. But anyway, Mr. Koppel was kind enough to give me a printout over the number of child care providers over a 10-year period of years. And every year we are losing more and more providers. I think over the last 10 years we're down over, was it over 3,000 providers, Commissioner Koppel?
Mr.
Chairman, I guess I'm not doing so good. Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, yes, it's over 3,000, as my recall, too.
Over 3,000 child care providers that we no longer have in the state of Minnesota, to which I would like somehow, some way, to be able to do, like, eventually do an exit survey when somebody chooses not to renew their license to find out exactly what the true reason is. I mean, I can say it's rules and regulations, but unless we actually have, as Representative Liebling would say, data, you know, it's all smoke and mirrors, right? But so we have lost over 3,000 providers over the course of 10 years, which is extremely concerning. And I don't know if you talk to parents in your area, but the number one age group that it's really hard to find care in is infant care. Parents have to start looking the moment that they find out they are pregnant and start searching for child care providers, you know, 9 months in advance, and then have to sometimes pay to hold that spot. And providers now are questioning whether or not they even want to take an infant because of the higher risks that go along with taking an infant. But back to a little bit of parent aware. Commissioner Koppel, part of the parent aware here is that if you are a 3 or 4 star rated program, there is a differential of 15 or 20% that is paid to that provider. Is that paid out of a different pool of funds from the child care assistance program, or is that part of the child care assistance program? Are those funds funneled away toward the 3 and 4 providers, thus taking away from families that could be eligible to get into, you know, having some sort of help to get into a child care facility?
Commissioner Koppel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, that all comes out of the CCAP funding.
Okay. So, in essence, so we have this child care assistance program, and we have close to 7,000 on a waiting list as of June 2014. The number here you have on in the budget is 6,679 families eligible for assistance, but who could not be served at the current funding levels. Does the department know how much money has been taken away from the child care assistance program to go for higher reimbursement rates to the 3 and 4 star providers?
Commissioner Koppel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, I would need to check and see what the cumulative amount of that money was and then translate that into a slide. If that's possible to do, I will, and I'll get that information to you.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, we're going to have to wrap up, so if you could go one more. And we have Representative Liebling and Loeffler also on the list, and we have 1 minute.
Okay. Then a quick question. We'll just shift. a comment and then a question. Regarding marketing, if we could have the the amount of money that ParentAware has spent on marketing, I see commercials, advertisements on Facebook, billboards, pamphlets, that type of thing, that would be helpful as well, and then to find out where that pool of money is coming from. And then my question is, what if somebody is a four-star provider and those children that are in that four-star program enter kindergarten and are found not to be ready for kindergarten? Because that's what ParentAware is marketing, ready for kindergarten. These are the best practices. Go to this three or four star and your kid is going to be good to go. What happens if that child is not ready for kindergarten?
Commissioner Kopp.
Mr. Chair and Representative Franzen, I would also need to get back to you. I believe that tracking right now, we're not... the tracking mechanism for kids that are ready for K has been a sampling, and it has not been consistent across the state. So I'm not sure if we have the methodology to link ready for K with the previous program and how long the child was in that previous program, how long it was four-star rated, et cetera. So I think there would be... It's an excellent point you make of creating linkages, but I'm not sure we have those linkages at this time.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I won't give a long speech here, but you know, I think there's a lot of agreement here, actually, a lot of bipartisan agreement around this. I really share a lot of your concerns, and what really concerns me about the proposal in front of us, you know, if we had unlimited dollars, it'd be wonderful to do quality ratings and, you know, all of that stuff. I mean, every child who's in childcare, of course, should be in the best possible program. But I really fear that we're putting our limited dollars in the wrong place to get the kind of results that Representative McDonald is really talking about, and that it continues throughout life. And I know you've all heard me say this, but really, the 0 to 3 is where the evidence is showing, you know, age 0 to 3 and probably pre-birth to 3 is where we really need to focus, I think, in order to really address some of these problems. And I really fear that this this budget proposal focuses the dollars in the wrong place. So I guess my question, Mr. Koppel, is, you know, how are we addressing the research that shows that the brain growth goes like that and the public investment goes like that? And I just fear that with the four-year-old proposal that we're just, you know, we're making the public investment a bit sooner, but we're still missing that very, where it really needs to go to make sure kids have the brain architecture for further success in life. Could you address that?
Commissioner Kopp.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, again, I think, are you speaking specifically to the universal pre-K, or are you speaking to the budget in general, or
Mr. Chair,
ParentAware?
Mr. Koppel, really all of it. I mean, to the budget proposal in general, it's, you know, great to put more funding for quality, but how is this addressing the most vulnerable kids who we really have to make sure that they get the best possible, because, you know, just... The sort of stuff that we know is really important for the youngest kids is the stuff that good parents do naturally, talking to children, interacting with them, holding them, singing to them, those kinds of things that kids in middle-class families and with good parents get, and kids in, you know, some families don't get so much for a variety of reasons. How are we addressing that gap?
Commissioner Kopp.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, in the Department of Human Services budget, and specifically in children and families, we do have some funding available on early intervention for at-risk families. We have, you know, some funding available, again, an increase in availability of and slots for child care. But, you know, I do believe that the emerging evidence around prenatal to three is really important to pay attention to. I'm a big fan of it personally, and I think it's one of those areas that is getting more and more attention. I know the in the Department of Education, the Part C funding that is there for early intervention at 0 to 3 or prior to 3. It's available to school districts. Is being looked at over and over again, how well is that going and how can that be improved? And they have, I believe, offered some recommendations this year. I agree 100%. I think it's an emerging issue that I hope continues to emerge, and we will work toward that in our future work as well.
Thank you, Commissioner Koppelman. Unfortunately, we have gone to the end of our overtime time, so I apologize, Representative Loeffler, and try to make it up to you in the next committee. And with that, members, we are adjourned.